You're listening to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. It seems everywhere you go today, you'll see help wanted signs. There are businesses limiting hours because of staff shortages. No one seems to have enough workers. There are several reasons, but here's one that is having a major impact. Millions of workers are quitting their jobs. Between April and June of this year, 11.5 million workers quit. A survey of 30,000 workers by Google found 41% are considering quitting, and a Gallup poll found 48% are actively searching for new opportunities. It's being called the Great Resignation, and it is the topic of today's Smart Talk. Our guest joining us on today's program, Philip Kane, who is the CEO and managing partner with Grace Ocean LLC. Kane authored an article in Inc. magazine detailing the factors influencing this phenomena. Also, Dr. Vivian Wilds, visiting professor of management with Bucknell University's Freeman College of Management, and Dr. Walter Licht, the Walter H. Annenberg Professor of History Emeritus at the University of Pennsylvania. I want to thank all three of you for being with us today. Philip Kane, let me start with you. Why are all these people quitting their jobs?
I started to look at this in May, June timeframe, and largely in response to the claims that the government was paying people not to come back to work. And I from what I saw working with a lot of small businesses, it seemed to me that it had to be much more than that. And so the more that I dug through this, it occurred to me that what was happening was, in preceding this great resignation, was really a great reevaluation on the part of all of these people who went home to work for the last year and a half or so. And for many of them, they decided that they had enough of many of the things that they were encountering in their work life before, whether it was having to go to an office or whether it was being treated the way that they were in the offices they were in before, or whether just deciding that there had to be more to life.
So those are some of the factors. We're going to talk about some of them specifically. But one thing I did want to talk a little bit more about, you said that you came at this from the angle of whether workers were not returning to work because of the additional benefits from the government, more unemployment, the $300 a week, at one time $600 a week. And from what you found, that wasn't a major factor in people not returning to work?
Certainly it was a consideration, but what I found that it was much more than that. It was from many of these people, and the research is showing that for well less than half of these people, the consideration for them not to return to work has far less to do with money than with other factors that certainly we'll discuss, but factors having to do, again, with the treatment they receive, access to mental health treatment, to flexible health working opportunities, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. So Dr. Vivian Wilds at Bucknell's Freeman College of Management, what have you found? Why so many people have decided to quit their jobs?
Well, first of all, thank you for airing on this topic, Scott. I think it's an important discussion that we should be having as a nation, really. You know, I think there's a lot of change in the air. And in many ways, COVID gave people pause to look at and to reassess, you know, what was important to them. So, and it was a long enough time, you know, 18 months in some cases, and it's still continuing. It was a long enough time that people needed to maybe reassess what they were going to do. I also think that certain sectors have been hit a little bit harder than others. For example, the hospitality industry is in dire straits, really. And so managers there really need to reassess what the employees need if they want them to come back to work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I could give you some different examples of that, but essentially, you know, people have other options available.
You mentioned hospitality. Actually, hospitality, restaurants, and hotels were the industry that was second on the list of where people were quitting. Retail was number one, but restaurants and hospitality. You know, a lot of people would look at that on the surface and right away say, well, that's because they weren't making enough money. I mean, is that part of the equation here that people are quitting because there are other options where they can make a better salary?
Well, it could be. I mean, I haven't done any research on this, you know, empirical research, but let's say, for example, if somebody's making $10 an hour to make a pizza, they're earning half a pizza an hour. And so it's just simply not enough. You know, they, so there's that part of it with the minimum wage and so forth. So people need to earn more. But they have other choices. I've had people say, well, I can do data entry for the same amount as if I'm standing on my feet for, you know, 8 hours, or I can work remotely taking surveys online for basically the same amount of money. So, you know, I think there has to be a lot of reassessment as if hospitality folks want the workers to come back in.
Dr. Licht, you are the Walter H. Annenberg Professor of History Emeritus at the University of Pennsylvania. You've written 4 books about labor, about work, about industry. Is there any historical precedence for this? I mean, when you have 11.5 million people quitting their jobs in a 3-month period, any historic precedence?
Let me speak to that, and thank you for the invitation to join this panel. I've had many reporters in the last couple of months asking me the same question for an analog in the past of a moment of crisis, which was accompanied by a remarkable and large withdrawal of labor, or what you're calling the Great Resignation. And I have been hard pressed to find a real good analog at any point of time. We've certainly had a long history of pandemics throughout human history, and most people remember the Black Death, which was a remarkable erasure of populations over a little 6-year period, actually, between 1347 and 1353, which, depending where you were, at least a third to a half of the populations were killed off, from China through Central Europe, Central Asia, the Middle East, the Mediterranean, and Western Europe. That led to extraordinary labor shortages. We're going through a period of labor shortages with a remarkable amount of deaths, probably 50 million people dying worldwide. And by the way, that took over 100 years to recover from that loss of labor and the resulting loss of commerce, et cetera. So we've had this kind of horrific, catastrophic moments of pandemic where we have removal of labor, but it's through death. So, by the way, that did not happen with the great Spanish influenza during World War I. I've just noted, by the way, that we are past in the United States the amount of deaths from COVID than from the Spanish influenza, but that did not lead to a period of labor shortage. I can tell you why. The only other analogy I can find is, of course, the dislocation that occurs after great wars. And what I mean by great wars are those wars that see a major mobilization of the population. In terms of fighting, as well as in wartime industry. And of course, World War I and World War II come to mind. And both of those wars saw dislocation right after, and periods of economic crisis right after. It takes time to readjust from total wartime mobilization to a consumer economy. And so you had a year or two where there was great shortages of consumer goods. And that created periods of inflation. We were experiencing that right now. So there's an analog. And with that comes, in that reconversion back to consumer production, you have these supply chain problems. So when I see these supply chain problems, inflation, there you have analogs to the immediate post-war periods. But again, you don't have, well, you probably have individuals making all sorts of decisions about what do I do next after I return from war. But you don't have that massive withdrawal of labor. Labor is waiting for everything to gear up to the normal domestic economy that will come in within a year or two after the conversion back to a normal economy. But so when I see an inflationary period like we're having here, supply chain issues, that has always accompanied the crisis of wars and major wars here. The supply chain thing is really multiplied now because the geographic expanse of those networks is enormous, you know, rather than purely domestic. I have one interesting thing, and I've been thinking about this, about an analog of a deliberate withdrawal of labor from a crisis moment. And I've yet to hear some historian come with this analog, so I'll suggest it to you and I'll pass it on to others. And I do have some thoughts about what's happening now, which I'll add later. But if you look at the immediate period following the Civil War, what we call a Reconstruction, you have the end of slavery, which is a forced form of labor. You're going to labor with under the, you know, the possibility of the whip, etc. We see the newly freed peoples of the South, and there are over 2 million adults, withdraw their labor. That's what freedom is all about, you know, on a scale of leisure to work. That's what freedom is about: choose more leisure than work. Also, they didn't want to return under any conditions that looked like slavery. And there was an attempt to reorganize in the South the workforce without slavery under the wage labor system and in the form of gang labor. And that was not seemingly much of an improvement over the period of slavery here. And most of the African Americans were holding out for land. There were promises of land. They wanted to be, you know, yeoman producers, just like in that ideal of the Jeffersonian Republic. They held out for land, and there was a withdrawal of labor, and there was no gearing up for full production, in this case, obviously, cotton production, for years. And there was a standoff between those who owned the land and wanted this work and those who were the land workers. And out of that became a negotiation, which led to sharecropping, you know, where people were given the rights to work the land as they saw fit, but they owed a share to the product. So there's a, for me, an interesting analogy, which I've not seen anyone, where there's a deliberate decision not to return to anything which is entirely exploitative, and to return to a kind of work. It's not great work, and it has its forms of exploitation, in which you're working under terms that you can set. And that's what sharecropping was about. You're not under the whip. You can work hard for 4 days and go fishing and hunting for a couple of other days. And that, to me, is the most an analogy I found of this conscientious decision and a collective decision not to return under the conditions of which you have.
That is different. Huh. Philip Keane, let me turn back to you for just a moment. As you mentioned when in our earlier discussion that there are factors going on beyond just the additional money from the federal government in the form of unemployment compensation, additional compensation. You were talking about, and in this article that you wrote for Inc., you talk about that a lot of it has to do with people just not being satisfied, or that they see this as an opportunity. What Dr. Licht just mentioned, talking about the end of a war, or he talked about the end of the Civil War, COVID is the pandemic that we've been through over the past 18, 19 months. probably could be compared to a war as far as disruption goes around the world. So you mentioned some of the factors, but let's get a little more specific. Why are people dissatisfied with where they work? How have they taken this opportunity to kind of sit back and reevaluate or reassess where they are?
I think Dr. Licht is onto something, to the extent that consider workers having the opportunity to be away from a workplace that many of them for years have considered to a certain extent exploitative. Certainly a comparison outright to slavery might be a bridge too far, but exploitative in their mind to the extent that it's for many of them toxic, abusive, not providing a level of care that they expect. And so to be away from that for a certain period of time was found by them to allow a certain degree of freedom. And so for many of them, they said, look, to go back to that is less attractive than not. The study, many of them that I've looked at, one of them said 28% of these people left with no prospects of a new job. And back to the money issue, roughly 37% of these folks who said, I found a new job, only 37% said it was for more money. 69% of them said, I took a new job because they care more for me. Roughly the same amount said, I took a new job because they provide greater access to mental health. So these people are making a decision to leave an environment that they find toxic, or to use Dr. Licht's word, exploitative, to find an environment that they find, in my word, more caring. And that, in a nutshell, is why they're leaving. They simply are making a decision to no longer accept the unacceptable.
When you say more caring, now when you say accepting the unacceptable, that they're no longer willing to do that. But when you say more caring, what does that workplace look like that these workers are looking for?
It looks like a workplace where workers have a say in what happens there. It looks like workers who are heard. It looks like people who are recognized for their contributions. It looks like a workplace where authoritative micromanaging gives way to a more servant-oriented and care-centered form of leadership of this century, not of the century before. It looks like an organization where it's okay to talk about being overwhelmed. It's an organization where it's okay to talk about mental health issues, things of that nature.
You know, I've read a couple accounts, especially in the hospitality industry, where workers are dealing with the public during this pandemic. And one of the things is, this is aside from how they are treated by their employer, but they were talking about one of the reasons they quit was the stress that they were under dealing with the public, constantly battling with customers about wearing masks, or customers making demands or complaining about how long something was taking to get done. So it wasn't just that they were unsatisfied with the employer, it was the customers as well. Did you find that, Mr. King?
I haven't seen anything specific in that regard, but to your point, fully 40% of, between 40 and 50%, depending on what data you look at, of people who have left cited being overwhelmed or burned out on their job as the primary reason for leaving their job. But no, I haven't seen any direct correlation to I'm feeling overwhelmed because of customers specifically.
Dr. Wildes,
but that's a great point.
Dr. Wild,
I do have some anecdotal
go ahead.
Evidence of that from different people who I've spoken with who worked in the hospitality industry, and including my husband, who actually sold his restaurant because he just didn't want to deal with it anymore, whether it was the employee problem, getting people, and the customers who were coming in, you know. So I think there is something going on there that people don't want to work as much with the general public. And the alternatives too, particularly for Generation Z, who are my students at this time, they definitely want to work. They're all about getting jobs. But it's a different sort of market that they're planning to go into, whether it's e-commerce, that's something that's attractive, you know, the platform economy, artists who make things, and they can buy and sell online without having to go in and actually deal with the general public. You know, social media has provided platforms for a lot of people to become superstars, but, you know, I think young people are watching this and saying, maybe I can do that too. You know, I don't want to be a cog in the wheel. Or if I go to work, I just want to go and learn from the employers and move on and start my own business.
I'd like to add, and I'm in total agreement about the kinds of dissatisfactions that our people are not running back to the jobs they once held. When you ask these questions, we really don't have that very fine-grained research. You know, we know in certain sectors what's happening, the hospitality industry, teachers and stuff, and these dissatisfactions. It would be wonderful to learn a little more if we could have a little more fine grade, break this down by region, by economic sector, particularly age, age cohort, race, gender, whatever, to understand this a little bit. Because I think Vivian is pointing to, I think, a generation of young people who have a irregular 30s and 40s, and I'm not talking about all of them, but a big tier of them have had an irregular relationship to the labor markets. They go work sometimes in spot markets. They work for a while, and then they pull themselves out, you know, traveling and finding jobs elsewhere. So, but that's a particular generational phenomenon, and I think we need a little more fine-grained research. Because all of this is correct, but I think there are different populations are reacting in different ways here. And I think, Vivian, that it's talking to a generation that's had a little history for 20 years of having a kind of an irregular relationship to regular employment.
Well, Dr. Lex, what you just bring up, think about it. What the age group that you referred to, the 30s and 40s, what that age group has gone through. Just 13 years ago, there was the Great Recession. Yep. And at that time, you know, and one of the differences in that recession is that afterwards, when a recovery started, jobs didn't come back as quickly as they right. did in previous recessions. So that generation that you're talking about has experienced something that a lot of other generations have not experienced, correct?
Yes, absolutely. And it's not just, you can say they came into this gig economy, and that's part of it, but I think their connections to regular employment have been through this disruptive period. And if you go to the other end, and again, we don't have the fine grain, I think there are people in their late 50s, maybe even prior to when they can withdraw Social Security, who are also making kinds of decisions about not returning to the kind of work they had for other reasons, imagining easing themselves into retirement. So there's a lot going on there. I think we can list all the dissatisfactions, but it would be great to see this a little more fine-grained research to understand how this is, particularly about the age factor is kind of really interesting to me, and I haven't seen the data on that.
Well, it may be a few years before we actually have the data, since it was only a few months that so many people quit. Dr. Wilds, what role or how much of a role did working remotely have on people quitting and deciding to look elsewhere?
Well, I think possibly it had a great role. I mean, for I'm in education, and I spent the last year teaching on Zoom, which was not, we made it happen and we were successful, but it wasn't a great satisfactory experience for both students and teachers. In other, you know, sectors, maybe it worked well. And so, you know, if people want to stay home with their dogs, their children, or they can, you know, work remotely. And so I think that gets also to the point that employers maybe need to offer some more options and even trusted employees to make those decisions and to know that the job is getting done, that it's not, you know, how many hours one puts in necessarily, but rather the job. So maybe there's some need for more empathic leadership, which kind of gets back to what Philip was saying, you know, caring, the caring workplace. And my guess, and, you know, I don't have the fine-grained research on this, but my guess is that we're going to see that empathic leadership is going to be more necessary as a strategy to get the best and keep the best employees, because the good employees can go somewhere else, you know, and you don't want to be stuck with all the lesser employees. So I think empathy plays a big role in this. Does that really answer the question about remote work?
Well, I did want to ask Philip about that, because you addressed this in the article you wrote for Inc., where you talk about that employees want to work when they were working remotely. They wanted to work for an employer, a boss, who didn't question whether they were fooling around and not providing 40 hours a week, but just what Dr. Wild said, that maybe the measurement is getting the job done rather than when you're putting in the hours or how many hours you're putting in. Is that part of what you were talking about, caring? And she mentioned the word empathy.
You're exactly right, and thank you for that, Dr. Wild. Because this whole remote work thing has been a bit of a double-edged sword for employers, but also for employees as well. Because for employees, they were all sent home and continued to be managed by the same cohort of managers who were not given any sort of training in how do you manage people who aren't with you all day. And the default mechanism for managers was, hey, I'm not sure what these people are doing all day, and so I'll naturally be suspicious of that, which added a sort of tension between associate and manager that led to a lack of empathy and a greater deal of control over associates, which they pulled away from, which led to this dissatisfaction that we've been talking about today, which led to statistically of about 60% of the people who are still working from home today, more than 40% of them saying, you know what, I don't care if I ever go back, because these aren't people that I want to be working with. So to Dr. Wild's point, what is needed is a greater degree of empathy for the fact that these are people who are just trying to work in an unfamiliar setup, and they need to be managed in a different way than they were when they were in the office.
Let's take a phone call from Sue in Dillsburg. Sue, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well.
Good. I just wanted to give my side of the story. I was a waitress for 3 days a week, and I also had a Monday through Friday job. And I actually left as well for many different reasons, and I did feel that it was very exploitative. I didn't get unemployment. Even though I lost all of my income as a waitress, my income at my day job did not allow me to get unemployment. So when we did go back to work, it was kind of like, well, everybody's working one day a week so they can keep their unemployment. There's extra $600. And then their extra $300, but it was kind of like everybody was all lackadaisical and laid back. It didn't matter. I just have to be there because I need to get my unemployment. And then the workload seemed to be more, and I still needed to make my income as a waitress. But I also felt that the restaurant that got millions and millions of dollars in relief funds that they didn't have to pay back, I feel they should have shared that with those of us who didn't get unemployment.
So, in other words, what you're saying is you did feel exploited, and that there were people who were taking advantage of the situation with unemployment.
Oh, of course, because they weren't going back to their 3 days a week. They're like, oh, well, I can't because I can't, you know, if I work more than this, I won't get my unemployment, the extra unemployment. So they'd pull their 1 day a week, and of course, it didn't matter whether they got five tables or two tables. They're just there to make sure they get their unemployment.
Sue, thank you very much for your call. Dr. Licht, what Sue's experience points out is that, like the comparisons you were making with wartime or post-wartime, is that this pandemic was a major disruption for employers, employees, industries, that, and as Philip Kane said, that people experiencing something for the first time, something they've never experienced before. And really, I don't know if there is an analogy there, but would you agree that this disruption, just her phone call alone, showed the kind of disruption this was?
Yeah, well, it's a major disruption, and what the end results of this, I think, are kind of up in the air at this point, and the kind of reimagining of workplaces and relationships of employers to employees. This is an open book right now. Yeah, it involved the mass of people, basically. Now, you do have people who were unable to work from home. I mean, you have that tier of service sector workers who are really on the ground, at ground zero in many instances, whether they were ambulance drivers or the service staff in hospitals. So again, we do have to remember that there's a group of people who never had the advantages or benefits of even having this, working at home and making that kind of decision. Well, I would prefer to be doing work at home, etc. But yes, this is a major experience in people's lives, where a mass of people are forced not to go into the normal returns to work here. I just wanted to say that I think in retrospect, this is a result of a 30-40 year people, a process where there's really been a break in something that had been accepted, not for all workers, because we still always had workers doing miserable jobs, but what I call a social contract of some kind of belief that employers create environments and benefit systems that encourage long-term loyalty to the firms and diligence, and in return, there's this kind of understanding that you could have a career in this firm, you know, and even if it's a blue-collar job with good benefits, with respect, with grievance procedures, if some kind of foreman is acting in capricious ways, that whole system, that kind of social contract, and again, it didn't include all parts of the populations, just broke down in the 80s. And there's just no loyalty. There's no, you know, we begin to get an era. There's this zero loyalty of employers to employees. Let them go. We're not taking them on for a long period of time and encouraging their loyalty for, you know, a lifetime and a career here. And in return, people became disloyal. Why am I sticking around here? So I think there's been a process that's come to the fore given the crisis moment. I don't know how Vivian and Philip think about that, but I think that's at work as well.
Well, Dr. Licht, let me follow up with you quickly. You know, one of the things that has changed, and I don't know, you know, this may be a complete other conversation, but it is a sidebar. is that union membership, for example, is down. I mean, it's like 10% of employees across the country are now members of unions. Now, I don't know what that has to do with loyalty, but it does have to do with some security and that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think it's the erasure, and by the way, it's only industrialized nation of the world. We've had a total erasure of trade unionism in this country. The only place it really survives is in the public sector. I mean, in the private sector, I think we're down to 6% of people working under union contract. It was on average at 35% throughout the post-World War II period. And in the mass production industries in the 80-90% are working under union contract. And that kind of instituted for me the social contract. You know, that you will come in, you'll be working under rules that are negotiated between management and the unions. There'll be grievance procedures. If any of the salaried employment people who are overseeing work are acting capriciously, you'll have pension programs, you'll have health programs, you'll have paid vacations, definite paid vacations. And it will all be negotiated and contractual relationships and built into them are going to be these fringe benefits rather than being gratuitous fringe benefits. We don't even have those pension programs anymore. Everybody's contributing to their own pension program. That to me has been, you know, part and parcel of the erasure, and there are many reasons for the erasure, but the erasure of trade unionism here. And you have workers acting collectively to see that. Workers have a hard time acting collectively today. And that's also led to the disloyalty because you think, I'm on my own here. There's no one helping me out, even my other comrades at work. And if I'm going to take off, I'm going to take off because my employers, they have no loyalty to me.
Mr. Kane, I know that you have to run. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. This is from Curtis. He says, I think something that isn't getting coverage is a lot of parents have left the job market because of the lack of childcare. Many daycares have closed since the beginning of the pandemic, and many grandparents are reluctant to watch grandchildren who are too young to get vaccinated. Dr. Wilds, Curtis anticipated one of the questions I've had because if anything this pandemic has highlighted is how important childcare is to workers across this country, especially women who have left the workforce or haven't returned to work, this seems to be a major factor.
Yes, I think maybe it was a forced choice too. But people work because they need to earn a living, and they work because they need the money. And it's always pretty much fallen on women to be the ones who are at the home. So going back to, you know, in history, I mean, women work because they need to work. Not all women, of course, but most people are working because they need the income. And so when those choices were forced, there were no daycares or they were closed, and you had to choose between work and taking care of your children, you know, and also with the education being closed and students learning at home, you know, people need to make decisions. And as I, you know, said at the top of the show, it was a long enough time for reflection for people to decide what maybe was most valuable to them.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a phone call from Nathan in Harrisburg. Nathan, you're on Smart Talk.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Yes.
So there's a lot that I could say about what's going on in the labor market right now, but one point that I feel is grossly underrepresented is this idea that, you know, at least for my entire life, which has been over 30 years, is I've heard this narrative that, you know, people are lazy and they don't want to work. And that's why, you know, all these positions are empty and people don't want to work or they're afraid of this or afraid of that. But what I've heard my entire life is that, you know, you need to get a better job. You don't want to be a burger flipper. You don't want to work at McDonald's. You don't want to work at Burger King. You don't want to work at low end retail. You know, it's always, you know, if you want to increase your earnings, you need to get a better job. You need to work at, you know, somewhere else. You need to pursue this type of skilled labor, quote unquote. And then all of a sudden, when there's a labor shortage and workers have a little bit more of a say in the agreement, then it turns into, oh, why is everybody so lazy? Why does no one want to work this job? And I just feel like that's a point that's being missed completely all the time, is that there's been pressure for decades on people to get better work. And then we just demean all these people working these positions and then wonder why no one wants to work them.
Hey, Nathan, thank you for your observations. Dr. Lick, what do you think about what Nathan had to say?
Well, about to this laziness argument, or people are living on the dole, you know, they prefer to get paid by the government, which is every survey research is that is the lowest, the answer has the lowest percentage when people say that. And back to what Vivian was talking about, my remember of one of the Kohl's is the highest percentage of people said, why aren't you going back to work? And childcare was number, it was the, had the highest percentage of people there. The whole question about, you know, it's interesting on these all these benefits, that when you look at the states that maintain the highest amount of benefits because the state was paying into them and support systems, those were the states with the highest percentage of people who decided to return back to work. So, you know, the benefits were there and they still decided to pay back from work. So that whole argument about people are not returning because they're living off the dole. And now those benefits are not there. And we're still seeing people not going back to work. And there is, you know, that the person who just called in said, you know, there is always that notion that, which is a good thing, you know, that I can work hard and then maybe I'll go on to something better. But what's interesting now is people are just thinking, I'm just not going to go back waiting for something better to come along. I'm going to look for something better, but I'm just not going to go back, spend a couple more years doing what I don't like. And it's exploitative waiting for that opportunity. They're just taking the time now to get something that is more meaningful and is better under better conditions of employment.
Yeah, Nathan, who was the caller, you know, one thing I could say is that this service industry needs to ante up. They need to give benefits to, as you call them, burger flippers, you know, for people who work in service and in the service and hospitality and the hotel industry. Those used to be big labor big labor unions. And yes, definitely since the 80s that, you know, that group has diminished. But I think in separating, you know, remote work from service work, service workers have to go into work and they have to face the customers and so forth. And if people want them to do that, then if the employers want them to do that, they need to provide benefits. You know, the days of working for fun in a restaurant are, you know, maybe it is fun and that's why people go to work after school or something. But those days are maybe over. I don't know. We're in a big change in a flux here. And the bottom line is people need to make a living and be able to pay the rents.
Mm-hmm. We only have about 4 minutes left. Dr. Wildes, what impact is this having on the economy?
I don't know. I mean, I'm guessing it probably eventually will have quite an impact. And my concern is that I read a Harvard Business Review study that said the largest reduction of workers is in the 30 to 45 age group. So there is some data on that. What I'm concerned about is, if somebody's not working, how are they going to get back into, how are they going to get into the economy, how, you know, own homes and have a decent, you know, lifestyle where, and so that's what I'm concerned more about is how do you, when you're unemployed or making less money, how do you actually engage in the economy? I don't know, Walter, you might be able to answer that.
Yeah. First of all, there are a lot of unknowns here. So, you know, in this crystal ball you look into, I mean, interesting, we do not know how this is going to affect, for instance, commercial real estate. You know, if firms decide to go hybrid with certain are working at home, certain with the office, they don't need all that office space. We could see a collapse in that part of the economy. The supply chain issues, it's hard to know how that's going to be resolved. And at the moment, I think the most serious problem is nothing can be done politically. This is a point where we may need some new kind of mandates and government interventions to ease out this crisis and even contribute to a reimagining of work and relations between labor and capital. That ain't happening in this partisanship. And that's why I think if we do go into a crisis with this high partisanship and one party refusing to participate in any thinking about this, we could be in the midst of a pretty deep economic crisis. Well, that's my great worry. We don't have the ability to respond now because of partisanship. That is my biggest worry about the future of the American economy.
And that's a whole other hour talk show.
Yeah, okay. Yes. Which I have many times. But yesterday we just talked about the great rural and urban divide politically. But it is. It's fascinating. Probably that's an understatement of how many issues are impacted by this partisanship, this polarization that we do have in this country. We had a listener who talked about there was a time when one person's salary could provide for a whole family. Said in the mid 90s, and over the road truck driver is earning $110,000 a year. Now it's $50,000. And, the other part about that, he brought up the trucking industry. I mean, that's where one of the supply issues are, because there aren't enough truck drivers or trucks to deliver some of these products we're talking about. Obviously, there is a lot going on here, but we are living through historic times, folks, and it may not be the most satisfying time. And as I think Dr. Lux said earlier, we may have to wait for the research to find out what's going on, but there is a lot going on. I want to thank our guest, Dr. Vivian Wildes, visiting associate professor of management with Bucknell University's Freeman College of Management, and Dr. Walter Licht, the Walter H. Annenberg Professor of History Emeritus at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.